Hello and welcome to episode number 5 of Potential Energy. I'm your host, Dr. Kirsten Sanford, also known as Dr. Kiki in some worlds. Potential Energy is all about investigating the problems with the current energy infrastructure and discussing potential solutions. Today we are discussing peak oil. I'm joined in studio by Alex Lindsay.
Hello, hello.
Hello. And via Skype, Andre Angelantoni. Welcome.
Thank you.
Could you please give us a little summary of who you are and why you have an area of expertise around peak oil?
Sure. So I actually have an environmental consulting company, and I was doing a lot of work in climate change. And around a year ago, I decided to look into peak oil because it sounded to me like it was going to be make a big difference in the amount of emissions that we were emitting globally. And I found out that, I got much more than I bargained for when I did that investigation. I discovered this whole concept of peak oil, and ever since then have been speaking about it, writing about it, and working with my local community. I'm the co-founder of Post Carbon Marin. And then this week, I've launched a new website called postpeakliving.com. And that's designed to teach people how to get prepared to live a life in a post-peak world.
So can you tell us... Nope. I'm going to stay out of...
Stay out of my order. Don't get in the way of my order of events here. I'm not to the question time yet.
All right. There you go.
I'll let you know when we're to question time, Alex.
See, she has to keep me in a little box most
That's
of the
right.
time.
Put you in your little box, mister. Thanks for telling us a little bit about yourself, and thank you so much for joining us today, Andre.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And now I just want to introduce the topic, what is peak oil? Since we do discuss alternative energy on this show, I think it's only right that we do pay some attention to the issue of petroleum, and specifically the idea that many believe is driving the current increases in the cost of gas, otherwise known as peak oil. And peak oil enters into the hypothesis, or refers to the hypothesis, that there's a limited amount of petroleum available on this planet. However, our petroleum and our energy needs continue to increase. Initially, petroleum production could match and, in fact, overtook our petroleum needs, but because petroleum's limited, there should be a production peak, after which point it should be harder and harder to produce petroleum as supplies dwindle. So it's believed by a number of people that we have exceeded peak oil and we are at the beginning of the end of society as we know it. So I guess I just want to start out with the first question of, you know, what are the implications of peak oil?
I actually have one question to jump into before that. And Andre, how would you define precisely peak oil?
Well, I think Kirsten did it.
Because a lot of people talk about it in different ways, about when it, you know, there's exploratory peak, you know, there's the production. There's a variety of different ways people are looking at this. So how do you define that when you're looking at it?
Yeah, well, Kirsten, I think, did a good job. It's essentially the point at which production can no longer increase, and in fact, it starts to go negative, which means that it decreases. And then one of the other confusing bits is that there are two sets of numbers that people look at. One of them is conventional crude, and then the other one is all the liquids that you can use like crude, and that includes things like ethanol and liquid natural gas and so on.
Now, would we include coal gasification with that?
Yeah, that would fit into the second category.
Okay.
So when you're looking at the world usage of petroleum right now, you're looking at roughly 85, 86 million barrels a day of all liquids. But the amount of conventional crude that is being pumped from the ground is less than that. I don't have this number exactly committed to memory. I think it's something like 75 million barrels a day.
And that's the easy, cheap oil. I mean, that's the easy, cheap energy that we've been getting for the last, you know, that's the diet that we've been on for the last 100 years, right?
Drill a hole into the ground and the oil comes squirting on out.
That's the mother's, that's the mother's milk, and we're now moving towards, I guess what we'd say, solid foods.
Yeah, maybe.
So the now this is all connected to the Hubbard curve. Is that still the Hubble curve? Is that still the Hubbard
Hubbard
curve? Is that a lot of what this is based on? or these theories?
Well, yeah, it was in 1956 that a fellow, a geophysicist by the name of M. King Hubbard, he started doing some research on when oil production would peak in the United States, and his prediction was that it would peak between somewhere between 1967 and 1970.
How accurate was he?
Oh, it was extremely accurate. It in fact peaked in 1970.
Now, I think the important thing is how was that received when he started that when he started talking about it?
He was asked strenuously not to publish the paper. He was working for Shell Oil at the time, probably through a combination as much of embarrassment as anything, because he was really the only one who was doing this kind of work and saying that oil, like all finite resources, there's really nothing special about oil. Eventually, you reach a maximum of production, and then it goes down.
And before that, everyone just thought there was just enough. The whole Earth was full of it, or.
We just have a crust and a core of oil. Is that the idea?
Was that how people were approaching it before that?
like the Earth is an oil jelly donut. I don't know.
Well, actually, don't laugh too hard. That's the abiotic theory of oil, which some Russian scientists think has validity. I don't spend much time on it because I personally don't think that the Earth is a candy filled with oily nougat in the center.
Yeah, but I mean, I have heard about this, the abiotic. Well, there's a biotic also, that there's, you know, life forms, cellular life forms that can create oil in the oceans or other areas, and then the abiotic, where it's the decayed organic matter that's smashed underneath the great forces of the planet's crust's movement, creating this product.
Yeah, and actually, it's worthwhile just mentioning that this is because you can tell what the source of oil is, and if it were abiotic, we wouldn't see markers that tell us that it actually comes from a biological origin.
Mm-hmm.
So and then there's very thin evidence that the oil fields are refilling. You have to really. People think that some oil reservoirs are refilling, but even if that were true, they're refilling so slowly that it's not going to come to our rescue.
Yeah, it's kind of like you have a big lake, and the lake is being filled by springs or streams, but that would, if you're taking water out of the lake faster, it's not going to matter at some point in time.
Yeah, but really, we shouldn't spend a whole lot of time on this, because we can tell by the biological markers that oil comes from a biological source, not from compressed rock or iron, like some of these Soviet scientists say.
And when we think of the biological source, are we thinking of algae? Is that a lot of what this is based on, or is it some other biological source? Do we know?
Well, sure. The oil was created in two globally warm periods, 90 and 150 million years ago. And it took millions of years to lay down that oil. And you can analyze oil, and you can discover roughly when it was formed. And the primary mechanism was the laying down of biological layers at the bottom of ocean sediments. Mm-hmm. And then when that mass of biological material was eventually covered over with rock, and then through some actions it got compressed and lowered and heated, and if it goes through this big long process, then eventually you get all the varying kinds of fossil fuels that we have, of which oil is just one of them. Oil has been there for a certain amount of time under a certain amount of pressure and at a certain temperature, and that's why we get oil.
Now, I think we should be pretty proud of ourselves. It took millions of years for the Earth to generate this, and it only took us about a century to get it all out.
Yeah, actually, well, from beginning to end, it's going to be something like 2 centuries. And we're right at the peak. It's actually kind of phenomenal, if you think about it. We've all gotten to live at the peak amount of net energy available for mankind. I mean, it's allowed us to fly across the planet to New Zealand, for example, and then complain about it.
Well, this brings up 2 points to me, is that, number one, we are at the peak, so, you know, although...
Well, are we at the peak?
This is what I'm going to say. If we are or just beyond what is considered the peak, you know, there's still a lot of oil left. It's just going to decline over time if there is indeed this limited quantity. Second of all, you know, the question is, people are still questioning, is this really a peak? And I guess there's three questions. So second, you know, is this really a peak? There have been other historical peaks in which we have, people have decried, you know, the end of civilization as we know it before and said, oh, we've used up all the energy we've got. And then technology came around to allow us to find new ways to get at what we could not be previously access. And I guess my third question is, you know, is this really the peak? Do we, I mean, we are estimating what is under the surface of the planet. And are these estimations really accurate when, in fact, we still have not explored 90% of the oceans? How do we know that this is really where, you know, where we are?
Okay, well, actually, those are all super questions.
And loaded.
A lot in there, right?
Loaded.
Totally loaded.
See,
she just
round
and,
up.
Well, bam!
You give her a couple minutes to sit back there and listen to questions, and bam, she comes out rolling. So,
That's right.
No, it's perfect, actually. You're asking, actually, all the right questions. And so let's see where to start. Okay, well, let's just look at the nature of the production of oil. It may sound silly for me to point it out, but you really do have to discover oil before you can produce it. And
right.
the peak of discovery was in 1963, and at that time we were finding the supergiants in the Middle East, and there was another really excellent series of finds roughly 20 years earlier. But those finds, those oil finds, have been shrinking in size ever since then. So peak oil does not mean that we're not going to ever find any more oil. You can actually statistically say that we're going to continue to find more oil.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that statistically, you're going to find the bigger reservoirs first.
Right. So now
not only
more
are you going to find the bigger reservoirs first, but it's much more economical for you to get the oil from the bigger reservoirs first.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're going to spend money on infrastructure, you obviously want it to have the access to the most amount of the resource so you can minimize the cost of the infrastructure across the whole resource. So what we've done is we've taken these very large oil basins, most of them in the Middle East, but also Cantarell in Mexico and then the North Sea, and we've depleted them, or we're in the process of depleting them. Almost every major oil basin is now in decline, which means that this year's production is less than the year before. Russia just announced 2 months ago that they've entered decline. In fact, I don't know of a major area that's not been reported to be in decline.
No, Russia had a decline. Didn't they have a decline in the end of the 80s in their production, and then it came back up again? Was that a...
Yeah, but you want to look at that more like it was due to the economy. They were doing
right.
They didn't adequately put in investment into their infrastructure.
They had a whole like collapse of the country that.
Yeah, I heard there was something like that.
Slowed
yeah.
things down a little bit there.
It did. I heard. Yeah, and so. But now, what you really want to do is you want to look at places where there's been all the money that you've wanted,
right.
all the access to the technology that's available, and no restrictions on drilling. One such area is East Texas. And it demonstrates that once the peak in oil occurs, you can throw lots and lots and lots and lots of technology at it, and there's not much that you can do to beat geology. It will go down your production,
right.
And that's just how it is.
Now, there's some people that are saying that part of the reason that countries are pushing and pulling over the North Pole is because they believe that there's hundreds of billions of barrels of oil underneath that cap. Is there any validity to that, or does it matter?
Well, it's certainly possible,
right?
But what's possible and what's probable are two very different things. Because
mm-hmm.
if you look at the geology of it, the North Pole, even 100 million years ago, was not the best place to have oil laid down.
Right.
The Middle East was the best place
right.
to have oil laid down.
Right.
So the geology is not in the favor of the Arctic. That's the first thing. The second thing is there have been some companies, notably... I think it's one of the Canadian companies
mm-hmm.
that went drilling up there, and they spent a lot of money, and they found nothing that was economically worth doing it, especially when you consider that you only have a few months of the year that you can bring in equipment, and everything is super expensive, and
right.
then trying to pull oil out in sub-zero temperatures with all the damage to the equipment that's possible. It's really an inhospitable environment.
Well, and I think that we're seeing some of the, I think we're also, we can look at the Middle East again to see Some countries, and not, I wouldn't say all the Middle Eastern countries, but there are some countries that are very forward thinking, and you can see that they're not investing their future in oil. When you look at a Dubai or an Abu Dhabi, you know, UAE in general, you're looking at a country that probably doesn't have as much, quite as much oil than some of the other countries, but they are very quickly trying to divest, very quickly, I mean, almost, you know, at a crazy pace, trying to change what brings in the money. And it starts to lead you to think that they may not have as much oil as we all think, that these, that what they call proven reserves or reserves may not be there. What are these proven reserves? I mean, are those hard and fast numbers?
Well, they're not, because a lot of the oil is actually under the control of state governments, especially in that part of the world. Only 10% of the oil right now is in control of what we might call the big oil companies. 90% is by the national oil companies. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those national oil companies, unless they're going out to market looking for money or partnerships, they just keep their reserve numbers to their chest. So you have to get at whether you think they're telling the truth or not through other ways. Now, one of the things that is making us very suspicious of the Middle East numbers is the fact that they haven't reduced their stated reserves.
They've arbitrarily increased them. I mean,
well, that was in the mid-80s.
Right,
that's right.
In the mid-80s, we went, Abu Dhabi went from 31 billion barrels to 92 billion barrels of declared reserves between 1987 and 1988.
That's right. Do you know why they did that?
Because the amount of oil, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's because the amount of oil they were allowed to export was based on their declared reserves.
That's right, as part of the OPEC cartel.
Right.
Right. So as soon as one person said, well, I'm going to increase my size of the pie or my slice of the pie so that I can export more and thus earn more cash, then all the other ones followed suit. So there was this massive inflation of oil reserves that independent observers calculate to be roughly 300 billion barrels.
Right.
And what we're going to hear in November of this year, when the International Energy Agency releases its next annual report called the World Energy Outlook, we've already been warned by the chief economist.
It's going to be bad.
That he's probably going to restate the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's completely authentic, right, because the only thing he has to go on is models now, because what he's saying is I can't trust the Middle East numbers. That this is what he said he didn't say it directly like this, but he's saying that he's never going to accept the Middle East numbers. And so now they have to pick which model of all the competing models is the most likely one for how much oil is there. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's a consensus that if he were to do the quote right thing, he would knock 300 billion barrels off the books, and I doubt Wall Street will like that very much.
That'll make people nervous. We have another sets you up for another 87 approach to things. Now there's people who will say that, well, we're just going to make it up in other energy areas. So we have ethanol, we have coal gasification. I mean, are those really going to make any difference?
No, because if you look at the alternatives one by one, you'll discover they actually aren't alternatives. And here's why. What people don't often appreciate is that first and foremost, we're dealing with a liquid fuels shortage.
Right.
So
it's not, all fuel is not even is what you're saying. You know, not all fuel is created equal.
Well, it's not just that not all fuel is created equal. It's just that you need fuel in a liquid form. We have cars and trucks and cranes and bulldozers and
not
so
everything
on.
Has gone to electric yet.
Well, actually, almost nothing has gone to electric yet. So you actually have to deal with the vehicle fleet that you have, not the one that you wish you had.
Mm-hmm.
And there are over 200 million vehicles, and the rate of turnover for just the cars themselves, of which there are about 140 million in the U.S. alone, is something like 15 years. So it takes 15 years to turn the whole fleet over. So that means that even if the technology were available on the market today, which it's not, you can't buy a single plug-in hybrid. You can do it aftermarket. That's not from a major manufacturer. Nor can you buy a mainstream electric car. The Tesla doesn't count. $100,000 sports cars, in my view, don't count.
That's awesome.
No.
There's nothing like a fast car being powered by laptop batteries, though.
I agree. I would love one of those. I'm a little bit of a car guy. I'm mostly a tech guy, but I would love one of those.
But yeah, but how many people have, you know, $100,000 to throw into a car?
Right. Exactly.
Not so many.
And the other thing that I think people fail to appreciate is that they somehow think that the penetration rate of this new technology will continue at the same rate as we're struggling in a depression caused by declining oil as what would happen in a fully healthy functioning economy. And I think they're just not thinking straight. If you can get 100 cars into the market in a month when you have a healthy economy, you're not going to get anywhere near that number of cars while we're dealing with declining oil in a declining economy.
Well, so coal gasification. Is there not enough coal, or is our ability?
There's lots of coal.
Right. There's all sorts of coal. People will tell us that there's two centuries. Of coal there that could be converted to oil, that could be burned in our car. Is that true?
It's the technology to convert it, though.
Yeah, well, okay, no, actually, there are two things. So that's actually a myth that there's 250 years. Mm-hmm. The amount of coal that is in the ground is nowhere near that. The National Academy of Sciences last year released a report that said that in their field checks, they found a small, quote, small fraction of the coal that was supposed to be there. And they immediately recommended that Congress authorize a very large project to really assess how much coal is in the ground. So the National Academy of Sciences, under no circumstance, is going to put its weight behind the idea that there are 250 years of coal. And in fact, if you start looking at the coal reserves around the world, they are being systematically decreased. In the case of Germany, 98%. A really great report for people to look at is the Energy Watch Group, which is a group that reports to the German Parliament, and they did an assessment of coal. They came out with something like probably it would be completely exhausted, around about 2100. Another place to go look is the video by Professor Rutledge of Caltech, and you can go to rutledge.caltech.edu and view his Watson lecture, and he'll walk through all the different coal areas around the world, and he'll demonstrate that there's not nearly the amount of coal that people thought. Now, the good news about that, of course, is that that means that there isn't nearly the coal emissions that we could get.
Yeah, because coal is a lot dirtier than the initial, you know, than petroleum.
And the gasification, is that technology ready? Does it matter?
It is ready, and it likely won't matter. Well, I'll be even stronger. For the public, it won't matter at all. It might help the military a little bit, and here's why. The Germans did get coal gasification to work and well during World War II. It's what powered their war machine. However, if you go to the industry advocacy group for the coal liquefaction process, the coal to liquids group, they will tell you that to make a plant that will give you a grand total of 10,000 barrels a day will cost just over $1 billion.
That's a lot of money.
Ouch.
Yeah. So remember, the world is using 86 million barrels a day of liquids, all liquids, and at 1 billion for 10,000 barrels, you can't imagine. We're not going to build many of those plants, especially not in a depression.
Right, the costs are going to be too high. Now, I mean, we can get back to the technology and the science in a minute. I'm just want to bring, you know, the implications of what peak oil means. You keep talking about how, you know, what's going to happen in a depression. But, I mean, so far, everyone's talking about the fact that, you know, we're in a mini recession, if that. Beyond that, what are the other, where else is petroleum used that it's going to have an effect on our lives, on the money that we spend to buy products, etc.?
Okay, there's lots to say about that. So for every $10 increase in a barrel of oil, that takes away $76 billion out of the American economy that could be doing productive.
Wait, say that again? For how much?
Every $10 increase in a barrel of oil removes $76 billion from the American economy that could be put towards productive use.
Wow.
Okay.
That's a crazy statistic.
Isn't that a crazy statistic? That's because we're using 7.6 billion barrels of oil every year, just the United States.
Hmm.
Okay.
Right.
And so it's a simple math, 365 days times 21 million barrels a day, and you get that number. So what we've seen is oil going from 30 to 50, and now it's roughly 120 dollars a barrel. So we have taken something like $333 billion of cash that would have normally gone to people's wages or even just profit for businesses to continue operating.
Or Iraq.
The irony of it. So you can't do that for very long and not have an impact. That's why we're in a. It seems maybe slow to us, but it's really going to look. We're going to look back, and it's going to be a blink of an eye. You and I, when we're talking right now, we're at the cusp of the depression, but we're actually heading into it. Mm-hmm. And if oil, when oil reaches $200-$300 a barrel,
which could be later this year, right?
Well, it may not be that high unless there's some sort of geopolitical event that stops the Strait of Hormuz. Let's say something like that. Then it probably won't be this year.
Now, some people say it could be
as soon as 2012.
Yeah. Some people say that the price of oil
2012 keeps coming up here.
I know.
So many things, like in like the last couple of days.
You know, well, the Mayans.
The internet. The Mayans. The internet is going to die.
So now the. Some people will say that right now the price of gasoline or the price of oil is inflated because we've got hedge funds that are basically offsetting their offsetting their investments. So they say that up to 25% of the price of oil right now is just because they don't have anywhere else. I mean that they're hedging against the economy. So when things go down there, they know that's going to keep on going up. We're hedging against the dollar. Is it really inflated right now?
That's definitely playing a role. Mm-hmm. But when you look at all the different factors, whether it's speculators or hedge funds or whatnot, it's not the fundamental driving force behind what's happening with oil. The fundamental driving force is that, by all estimates, the world needs 87.5 million barrels a day, and we're only producing about 85 million.
Well, and it's not only that. We need more every year, right? I mean, because there's been a huge change in our demography. Over the last 50 years worldwide. So it's not just, you know, the United States. It's everybody needs more oil all the time.
Yeah, we're actually seeing this big bulge of people in Asia who go from needing maybe a quarter of a barrel of oil a year, and then they buy their first car, and boom, now they need 10, 15, 20 barrels.
Right. You have Tata now selling cars for, what, $2,000? $2,000, $3,000, so that everybody in India can have one. Like that's something we really want.
Yeah, but now let's not forget, though, that it's convenient sometimes to think that it's all happening in China and India, but the United States population is right now still growing at 30 million people every decade.
Well, and we're much better at using oil than they are.
That's what I was going to say.
We're very highly skilled, and we got Hummers.
Even though we're looking at these nations coming into industrial status and like first world status, they're buying cars, they're using more oil. The United States is still using substantially more per capita.
Well, not only that, we set the pace. I mean, we're the ones that a lot of people are trying to emulate. When people think about when we've made it, this is what we're going to look like. Unfortunately, a lot of them look at, I mean, I see this in Africa. Unfortunately, what people look at is the American lifestyle and the American, you know, whatever they've been fed, because we send all our, you know, LA law is still playing in East Africa, you know. And so that's what we expect to see, you know, or that's what they expect to see when things have turned out. And so they keep on rebuilding the mistakes that we've made.
Right.
Now, no one is actually going to get away with what's about to happen to the global economy. I invite your listeners to go read on one of my websites, on inspiringgreenleadership.com, I have a blog, and in that blog I have a write-up on various economic papers. And what will be the speed of the global economic decline? And the best that I could see from some of the best papers out there is something like a 1-to-1 ratio. So every percent that we lose in oil production, the world economy will go down roughly by 1%. And that's using some great work by Deutsche Bank and also by looking at the oil shocks in the past. You can gauge how much oil is needed for each percentage of GDP. That means that if oil declines at the expected rate, which is a minimum of 4% per year, could be as much as 8% per year, we are facing an astonishing possibility that in 5 years the world could lose 20% of its oil.
And do we think is there anything we can do? Is there anything that'll cushion that blow at this point?
Right.
Yeah, there are two things that we could do. The first one is we could collaborate as an entire planet. We haven't done very well with climate change on that, so I'm not very hopeful on that. But we could all do something like a power down situation where we reduce our usage consciously as opposed to letting price eventually do it for us. That's one way. The other way is that we could enter a very deep recession, rather a depression, and that will cut back. That will create something called demand destruction.
Right.
Demand destruction is a euphemistic way of saying that your economy is in shambles, and factories are shutting down, and companies are shutting down, and therefore the oil actually isn't needed anymore. That's
right.
Another way. If you reduce the demand, you will eventually lower the price.
Mm-hmm.
But you will only buy yourself a bit of time, because eventually the oil that you would have used anyway is going to get used, because the transformation of your economy from a petroleum-based one to an electric one or whatever else you advocate actually happens slower while you're dealing with an economic crisis.
Right, there's not enough money to invest in those areas, but at the same time, I've been hearing a lot about in the U.S. especially the way that recently we've gone into this boom and bust economic cycle where the last boom that so there was the tech boom that ended up in a recession. All the money that was lost there actually had to go somewhere, and that went into housing. And so housing ended up going into the next boom. It is now in the bust, and a lot of people are suggesting that the green sector is going to be the next area, and it's timed just right that if all the money that was lost in the housing bust is now, if it now gets invested somewhere, like the green sector of the industry, and the timing seems perfect to develop things like solar, all sorts of other things that could take the place of the energy demands for that are for industrial applications. Maybe not take care of the liquid demands of our car and truck fleet, but it definitely could take a lot of the requirements off of it.
I wish that were true. We're just starting way too late. If you read the 2005 Department of Energy report, which is now affectionately known as the Hirsch report,
mm-hmm.
you'll see that we needed to start two decades before the peak, and it had to be an all-out effort if we were going to at least have the chance of a soft landing. And by this time, we would have had to have something like 90% of our economy already moved over. And the reality is that we're not even starting. And if we were to start, we would be basically starting past the peak. So there's really no way, in my view, and in a lot of peak oil educators' view, to avoid a crash landing.
Do we think, though, the view of peak oil is, one view of what's happening out there. There are people... who are still thinking, who are still maybe of the, well, we don't really know perspective. And there are yet other people who are saying, no, there's plenty of oil out there still for a while, although it seems to be in decline. Let's get into the conversation about other liquid sources, such as the oil that's in shale. There are technologies that are being developed right now that are actually in testing to be getting the more solid yet still liquefiable petroleum products out of hard to reach areas. So the technologies are coming along, and they're just about here to be able to access petroleum that hasn't been accessible before. And if that's possible, that's going to hold back this peak that you're thinking is going to happen, or this the decline that you're thinking is going to happen within the next 4 to 5 years.
Well, actually, it can't, because it would have already have to be producing right now, and they would have to be spending money to expand production for it to have any noticeable effect in the next 5 years. And if it's still in the laboratory, or even if it's in the field and they're still doing some field testing, it's far too late for that technology. You really have to look at the technologies that are implemented right now that are tested.
Because even with oil, if you find something now, you're not getting any sizable amount of oil out of the ground in that location for another decade, right?
Yeah, it can take up to 10 years from fiscally sanctioning a project to first oil. Sometimes the bigger projects now are taking between 6 and 10 years. The average actually is 6 years.
Okay.
Between when a project is fiscally sanctioned and when you get first oil. So Kirsten, just going back to what you were saying, it's actually too late for any technologies that aren't already commercially proven. You can't push off the peak. What you might be able to do is mitigate the decline a little bit. But it's only a fraction.
So now should we start? Are we in a position where we should start making sure we have 2 years of food and water in the house? Or is there for the average person listening to this? Is there a way out, or are there certain areas that are going to be less impacted?
I think so. My wife and I have 3 months of food in the house, and we're looking at what we're going to do to produce our own power. We're probably not going to spend the cash to put a solar system on our roof, but we're going to buy a few solar panels so that we can get electricity, because the grid is going to become unreliable, just like what we're seeing in South Africa or India or Pakistan or Bolivia. That will happen
that's
here
not,
in the
That's
US.
Not unusual. California has rolling blackouts in the summertime all the time anyway. California's used to it.
Well, but a lot of Americans are in this zone of that electricity is something that always happens when you plug something into the wall.
Yes.
You know, and you know, when I do a lot of work in Southern Africa, and I'm used to, you know, I am prepared. People always ask me why I'm always traveling with 4 batteries, you know, for my laptop, and I'm like, well, that's a day. it's a day of work, you know, in Zimbabwe, because, you know, I just need to know that I'll be able to keep on going between the outages, and it can be anywhere from 4 hours to 2 days. Between times I get to sip on that electric straw again, you know, and it's a different reality.
It is, and we're going to see that here, and it's not necessarily from peak oil, although eventually it will be because of peak oil, because the electrical grid is supported by this infrastructure of oil. Oil allows the technician to get up in the morning, get in their truck, and go to the utility yard, pick up that truck, and then go fix the problems, for instance. It allows the transformers to be made and to be delivered. So in one sense, all of our systems are dependent on oil. And as oil goes away, it's going to be really difficult to keep the water pumping, to keep the sewage going, to keep the electrical grid up. And that's, the technical term is called energy descent. We're at the period of maximum energy, and then as oil is removed from the system, it's going to impact all the other ways that we run our life. Now, before we get too deep into that, I try to make sure that when I speak to people, because you can go down a really dark tunnel, right? Really quickly.
Yeah, okay? You can.
I was looking for razor blades just a minute ago.
You're right, yeah. Kirsten, come back. Sorry, down there, okay? So just come
Hand
to the
me the
voice.
Gun.
Just come to the voice, okay? And what's gonna make a difference is a couple things. One is, obviously, if people get prepared ahead of time, that's better. If they don't, but community is really going to make a difference. We're going to have to rely on each other in a way that we may not be used to here in North America. And we're going to have to reassess our lives. But that's actually an opportunity, because if you take a look at what we've done with our society, a lot of it is great. You know, I just came back from Vegas because I was committed to seeing Vegas before it disappeared. I thought it was, you know, outrageous and fabulous, and I wouldn't want to live there, okay? So I actually have little problem with Vegas. But the reality is that there are a lot of things that didn't work so well about our society. And the planet in particular really got punished badly. It's unsustainable what we've done, not just economically, but from the ecosystem standpoint. Now, unsustainable means it can't be sustained. And that means that those ecosystems which are giving out from underneath us would eventually fail. So we're just having oil fail first before we've had any other number of systems upon which we depend fail, whether it's water or soil depletion and so on. So peak oil is going to be the first of a set of major things that we're going to have to deal with. It's about a dozen of them, if you really count them up, that we're going to be dealing with all at the same time. So community is going to make a difference. People getting prepared is going to make a difference. And then, of course, leadership is going to make a difference. Like, whoever hears this, if they constitute themselves as a leader in their community, and they look at what is it that they get to contribute to their community, they actually have an opening for a wonderful and fulfilling life. A lot of people who are working on peak oil issues and gave up their job, maybe they quit their Wall Street job or whatever, they're finding that they're actually much more fulfilled with whatever role that they're designing for themselves in preparation for peak oil. And that's the opportunity for people. Well, that's the beautiful part of it.
In a lot of ways, there's a lot of things that we've been allowed to do because oil was super cheap. Being able to live in one place and drive, 40 miles to go to work, mm-hmm. Is something that, we're probably not going to. I mean, I know that I've been looking at some spaces that are not in San Francisco. I don't own a car. I commute on the cable car. But I was looking at places outside of San Francisco. And even when I started doing the math on what it was going to take today, not tomorrow or 3 years from now, it's still expensive. It's expensive to be in Petaluma or in if I had to commute. And so with all of these calculations came, if I'm going to be moving, if I'm not in San Francisco, if I'm in Santa Fe or if I'm in Portland or wherever I'm going to go, I am going to need to know that I'm going to be working out of my house. I'm going to be working in the community that I'm in. And that's something we haven't done for, 100 years.
That's right. The term that I use is hyper-localization.
Yeah.
I think we're also going to see in... that localization is going to happen. People are going to stop wanting to commute. We're going to see many people trying to move into the cities. People who work in the cities, who work in the urban areas and then live in the suburbs. The suburbs are going to, dry up and cities are going to become extremely impacted.
Or maybe.
Maybe, but also.
Maybe. That's hard to know which way that's going to go. Because cities, by definition, can't produce enough food for themselves, right?
Well, and I think that the other issue is whether the cities as they stand now are sustainable in a post-peak oil world. The problem with LA is that 70% of the square footage of LA is dedicated to cars.
Right. LA is one place. I just saw a report that came out like a week ago that said that places like New York and San Francisco are actually the people who live in those areas consume less energy than people who live in other areas because they're actually taking public transportation much more often. They're walking. The food that they're getting, maybe it's not coming from local farms, but everything comes in bulk. And
I was
so
just
it's
in
not
New York,
such
and
small shipments. To
I don't
get
know
stuff
why
in.
Anyone. In, I don't know why anyone in New York owns a car.
Oh yeah, you know, you'd never own a car. Insane. I would never own a car in New York City.
Yeah, and I don't know if anyone else here is familiar with it, but there was an architect, a Paolo Soleri, years ago. I mean, 30 years ago, started playing with the idea of cities with no cars, what he called arcologies. But these are, reactions to things that weren't a problem then, but are much more of a problem
much
now.
Much more of a problem now. Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see what people do.
Well, I really ask people to take the bull by the horns and start designing what they're going to do rather than letting it happen to them. And to that end, because I give so many public presentations and people come up to me, well, that's great. You told me the problem. Now what do I do? Mm-hmm. So what I did is I created an online book. It's free. It's called The Guide to Post-Peak Living. And it's available at postpeakliving.com. And it has chapters on energy and transportation and where do I live and what skills do I need to build for myself and what do I do with my community. And it will give people a place to start for preparing. And what I do in there is I really look for, I really try to be clear-eyed with people. I don't think that we can get out of this. So I want people to get past that, to accept that energy descent is a reality, and then start getting busy on rearranging their lives, learning how to grow food. We did an amazing job with food during World War II. Up to 40% of the nation's vegetables came from Victory Gardens. And the city of Paris at the turn of the last century, that's the 1900s, it was using the French intensive farming method, which we would call the bio-intensive method now. And they produced so much food within its confines that it was a net food exporter.
Okay. That's fascinating.
So we can get busy and we can actually create thriving communities, and a lot of that is going to come from the growing of food. It takes only 2% of the American populace grows the food for the other 98%. That ratio is going to dramatically change. And there's going to be a lot more labor in our life. If you add up all the energy that we get from natural gas, and from gasoline, and from coal, and from uranium, it's roughly equivalent to having 300 energy slaves working for us around the clock.
Hey,
if you think about it,
I've been trying to think of all that.
That's right.
You know.
That's right. Well, you know, it's not a wonder that slavery ended when petroleum came on the scene. So we have to be careful that we don't slip back.
Right.
And we got to talk about that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing to start the discussion. You know, many people think it is too late. I think it's going to be interesting to see what people actually take to heart and what they do to within their own lives. I mean, whether it is as a result of hearing about climate change and changing your lifestyle for that reason, or changing your lifestyle for the idea of peak oil and the fact that, or you know, that oil may be in decline, and you know, it's going to be interesting. Americans, you know, they might step up and make changes. Or they may not, and people will be taken by surprise.
Well, and I think that unfortunately, a lot of times the human condition is to wait until things are really bad before you
wait until it's too difficult. You don't fix the
levees until New Orleans is already underwater.
Yeah,
that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, we're about at the end of our hour of conversation. Thank you, Andre, for all your wealth of information, albeit
you're very welcome.
A little bit depressing, but you know, I think it's good for people to start thinking about things and taking a look at you know, everything that's going on in the world, and the things especially that may affect them the most, and trying to make decisions about what they want to do and how they want to do it. And I think that some of the links you've given during this hour are going to be very helpful for people to take a look at. You know, peak oil is the term. Google is still available until the internet ends in 2012. And we still have the energy to be able to check it all out. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Kiki Sanford.
And on the next show, we're going to have...
We are going to be talking about photovoltaics, PV cells, solar cells, and how they work, and what different kinds of cells are out there that can help us take advantage of solar technology.
And until then, don't leave the light on for us.
Click.